From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Brian Sweetick says there are fantastic exotic creatures out there that have not yet been discovered or examined, but he doesn't think one of them is Bigfoot, or the Loch Ness Monster, or any of the other beasts that are at the center of the field of cryptozoology. He's puzzled by people who wander off into the wilderness looking for large footprints when there are incredible species out there that do exist. For Sweetick, this is about the scientific process. What kind of standard do we have for people who say Bigfoot exists? Where's the evidence, he says, the skepticism? Today in the program, we're talking about Bigfoot as a way of understanding how science works, or should work anyway. We'll also talk about why people tell Bigfoot stories, why we want there to be such a creature, or as they used to say in the X-Files, why we want to believe. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last year, we did a program where we featured the work of the anthropologist Jeffrey Meldrum. He's a tenured professor at Idaho State University, and his claim to fame is that he says he has scientific theories and evidence, he says, that presents a case for the existence of Bigfoot, or a creature that has come to be known as Bigfoot. Well, Brian Sweetick hated that show. He didn't have a problem with our interest in Meldrum himself, but he was troubled that we didn't apply more rigor in challenging Dr. Meldrum's ideas and, more particularly, his evidence. Today in the program, we're talking about Bigfoot again, and we have Brian Sweetick with us. Sweetick says there are costs to this kind of thing, wanting to believe in a supernatural beast. He says it blurs the line between belief and the scientific method. It lowers our standard for evidence. He also says it distracts us. So we're talking about that, but we're also talking about why it is we tell these kinds of stories, why we have these kinds of ideas. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brian Sweetick is a freelance science writer based here in Salt Lake City. He blogs about paleontology for National Geographic. He's also the author of the book Written in Stone, which traces the history of evolutionary science. And he's joining us here in the studio. And Brian, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to start with this because you've written about the fact that you yourself, when you were a kid,
right,
something like 5 years old, you yourself had been enchanted by these tales of encounters with Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and those kinds of things. First of all, and we'll spend more time with this question of why, but you yourself were interested in all of this when you were little, and I guess the question is why? Why do you figure you were interested in it when you were a kid?
It's hard to say. It sort of fits in with fascination with dinosaurs in the way it's something big. It's something monstrous, unknown. It's still out there, and it would give me the chance to be an explorer, you know, go to a jungle or a forest and find the sort of thing. It was sort of the temptation of the unknown, that there's something out there as yet undiscovered that, you know, maybe I can have a crack at.
So you get it when people – you get the fascination that other people may have.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. But at some point, of course, you stopped – believing.
Right.
Because why? Because is it just straightforward? Because there wasn't any compelling evidence that suggested it was true.
That was pretty much it. Yeah. I mean, I really, out of all of them, I really wanted the Loch Ness Monster to exist because that one had a chance to be this marine reptile called the Plesiosaur, sort of this long necked, sort of four flippered animal, this sort of holdover from the Cretaceous period.
Yeah.
And there was just nothing. So, sort of when the scales fell from my eyes, so to speak, you know, I looked back at all these other, you know, famous monsters, you know, their footprints and their stories, but that was really all there was. There's these barest traces, and there never seemed to be anything beyond that. And then when I became a science writer and I started to think about, okay, what constitutes a hypothesis and how do we test that, they just didn't hold up anymore.
Right. So let me ask you this. You didn't have a problem with the fact that we had Meldrum on the show.
Right.
Your problem was that we didn't say, okay, what journal? Mm-hmm. Okay, what is the evidence? That we weren't more skeptical or rigorous in saying, all right, give us the evidence that you've got for all of this. Is that essentially it?
Yeah, that was the heart of my argument, especially because right now in terms of cryptozoology, it wants so bad to be a real science. It really, really wants to be recognized. There's a, they've had their own journals. They've tried and give talks. They hold their own conferences. And a lot of it is science-ish. You know, so you have some people like Jeff Meldrum, who was on that show last year, who are actual anthropologists, you know, tenured professor, who actually have some scientific cred. There are other people who are more self-styled explorers who go out into the woods and they want to be sort of, you know, the Bigfoot researchers or the Loch Ness Monster researchers. But they don't really hold themselves to the same standards that professional science – they don't act professional is the thing. And it can be easy for that line to get blurred between, OK, what is actually science? How are these people actually testing this? Or is this just someone who really, really wants this to be true and is just finding a way to express their belief in a sort of mildly technical language?
You know, it's interesting because if you're a documentary filmmaker or if you're a producer of a show like ours that's interested in – not just the evidence of all of this, but the people themselves. Like, wow, a tenured professor up in Idaho State, and this guy is he's Mormon. I think that was interesting for us. And he has this theory, you know, based on what he says is his, you know, his research into, you know, early hominid locomotion, all that kind of thing. And I think the question I wondered is, what's wrong with us profiling people like that? I mean, you know, there's these eccentric people or people who have these impossible or implausible dreams.
Right.
It's full of literature and art and shows like this, I think, in some way. So what's wrong with that? You're saying there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
But it crosses a level when we treat it too seriously or something?
Seriously, but I think we need to push people when they say they believe something really exceptional. If somebody came on the show, to borrow Carl Sagan's famous example, and said, I have an invisible dragon in my garage. That might make for a fascinating story, a fascinating profile. Why do you believe that? Who is this person? Especially, say, if they're like a Nobel Prize winning physicist or something that's coming out with this claim. But at the same time, I think we have to push a little bit and say, okay, well, how do you know? What is the evidence you're using? What is the standard of evidence? And, you know, how are you backing this up? You say that you've published this in journals. Is it, you know, a journal that you're cranking out from your woodshed in the backyard, or is this like Science or Nature or something like that? I picked that example because Sagan, you know, brought up a point. You can say there's an invisible dragon in your garage, but, you know, you'll be able to bump into it. You should be able to feel it. You might be able to see its breath. You have to feed it things. There are different kinds of evidence that should suggest that there is something actually there. So even that something sounds entirely implausible, there are still ways to sort of test the existence for that. And as a science writer, that's really what I'm concerned with, is especially now when we have young earth creationism being pushed in elementary schools, global climate change denial, people who think vaccines cause autism. It's really, really important to get people to think scientifically. Like if somebody makes a claim, how do we test it?
You write about things that you see that trouble you in science journalism in general. You wrote in a piece for Wired that it can be difficult to inject context and history into discussions about science. And you say in some ways it amounts to just these short reports on new discoveries without really a bigger picture. Why do you think that is? It's just because people have low attention spans. They're not interested in that. Why do you figure is the problem? It's the sort of the new media, all of those things. Why do you figure?
It's hard to say. It's something I've been, you know, sort of wondering about, and the reason I write those opinion pieces because I'm not entirely sure. It seems to be the standard model, though, that when a new paper comes out, and I've done a bit of this myself for a number of journals for Science and Nature and other news sources, that you get 500 words and you have to say what the discovery is, what the finding is, and then a reaction from another researcher. And that's not very much space at all, especially if there's a controversy, especially if this plays into some bigger picture. It's difficult just to find the space, and that's just the model that's used. You know, I'm not sure what – I think that the average reader, if you write well and you make it a compelling story and you keep it tight, they'll stay with you through something that is genuinely interesting. But in general, the model is, you know, just keep it short, keep it to the findings, get your comment from an outside researcher, and that's just the way that it's done.
Yeah. The journal Nature, you point out an editorial that they had written a while back, which dealt in part with the kind of what they call this overreach in science journalism. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about it because you say – they said anyway, and you referred to this mm-hmm. drew you in, journalism favors attitude over accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they were getting at? What caught your eye about that?
Well, anytime an individual paper comes out, and this circles back to what we were just talking about, is that we want it to be big or significant, or I mean, why bother writing about it? Yeah. So if you get assigned a story, and you know maybe it's not as earth-shaking as you know, you think it was, because you know when you face it, just publishing in a journal doesn't mean something is a fact. It is often the statement of a hypothesis, or it's putting forward some new evidence. You know, science is an ongoing, exceptionally messy process.
Yeah.
So, you know, if somebody, you know, finds a new fossil, let's say, like moves the origin of the first eyes back like 10 million years, that isn't necessarily a fact. You know, you're definitely going to have other researchers saying, well, those aren't really eyes, those are antennae or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you lose some of that when there's this push to keep it short and to really grab people. There's a push to sort of create, you know, eye-catching leads, snappy lines to end the article on. And that's sort of what is often favored in science journalism.
So we want it to be more tidy than it might be.
Well, we should pick and choose our stories a little bit more carefully. Yeah. And you know, if something really isn't that amazing, maybe we shouldn't really be talking about it until something better comes out. Or if something is part of a big controversy, take a little more time to lay out that history and that controversy. Especially with the internet, we have all the space in the world. There's no reason to keep it, you know, to 300 to 500 words anymore. If it's really that interesting and that compelling, we can find room to tell the story correctly, yeah. I feel.
Let me come back to Jeff Meldrum. Mm-hmm. And Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever they call it. Is there any actual evidence that you've been able to find at all? I mean, there are no bones. No bodies ever been discovered.
Right.
There's no fossil record of large apes moving into North America. I'm not sure if there's – I guess people have said they found scat and said they found hair.
Mm-hmm.
But can you tell if there's really been anything at all that you think is mildly legitimate related to this story?
I haven't seen anything that has really, really struck my attention to say, you know what, there might be something here, especially with footprint evidence we have, which, you know, that's the big one. That's the one that really sparked
the sort of
Sasquatch craze. You know, in 1958, you had these footprints that, you know, modeled after the Yeti ones in the Himalayas were, you know, made, I think it was Bluff Creek, California, and later turned out to be a hoax. But at the same time, that created that meme of Bigfoot in North America, and it really took off from there. And that seems to be the one, you know, people say they have scat, they say they have hair. A lot of times turns out to be black bear hair or bison hair or something like that, or never gets tested. You know, anyone can find hair in the woods and say that, you know, Bigfoot was here. The tracks look distinctive, but I think that's often because they're hoaxed or they're not really Bigfoot tracks at all. We know what human footprints look like. We know what ape footprints look like based upon modern studies, and also footprints in the fossil record. And they're very distinctive things that they do in terms of when you push a real foot into the sediment, how it pushes up on the sides, how you get under tracks, all these little tiny details that just don't seem to exist. It looks like just a flat plank of wood, you know, carved into the shape of a foot, just pressed down into the soil. I mean, now there's somebody saying that they have DNA evidence of Bigfoot. It's a veterinarian in Texas who said she's been working for years on doing this.
What do you make of that? Because that's been the latest thing that's caught people's attention, of course.
Yeah. I think it's a perfect example of how not to do science, honestly. She's, you know, in the interviews that she's given, I think her name is Melba Ketchum.
Melba Ketchum, yeah.
Yeah. She says she's got, you know, DNA from hair, from blood, from scat, from saliva left on blueberry bagels, which, you know, it's just so specific that, you know, that must absolutely clinch the argument there. just all these different sources, and says it's identical to human DNA in some respects, and it's unidentifiable in other respects. And that means that, you know, humans and Bigfoot must have interbred sometime in the past. But she's putting forward all these findings from research that she's done through her own DNA company that she started before there's actually a paper. So she's putting out these findings saying, we're submitting this to peer-reviewed journals. So nobody else has seen this. Nobody else knows who she's working with, what she's doing, from all these sources that obviously it looks like some kind of contamination. You know, there's no detail about how this stuff was sampled. So it looks like getting the scientific process entirely backwards. It's not, here we have something, you know, that might be from an unknown animal. Let's go to someone with expertise in, you know, paleogenetics, like the people who are working on like the Neanderthal genome or these other unknown humans that we actually know existed from fossil evidence. Work with them, see if we can get something going, determine what this is. And instead, they keep to their own sort of group and then put out the findings before there's really anything to talk about.
It's interesting. I wonder if you – one of the things that comes up, Jeffrey Meldrum writes about, for example, mm-hmm. is the fact that, as he puts it, science is conservative, really conservative, and that in some ways, there's almost this bias against, you know, I think his perspective is because mm-hmm. he's chosen this field of study mm-hmm. that in some ways he's being discriminated against. And there's he, for example, has this connection with George Schaller, who's this mm-hmm. prominent mammalogist and biologist. Sure. And Schaller, I guess himself is kind of a skeptic. Mm-hmm. Like I don't get a sense he's a believer in Bigfoot, for example. But he seems to be troubled by the fact that the scientific community is not applying the same kind of rigor to this question that Meldrum is raising. He said mm-hmm. he doesn't believe it's fair to just dismiss it without some kind of legitimate scientific review. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? And what do you think about that? You mm-hmm. talk to scientists all the time. You yourself are one. They tend to be more skeptical. Are mm-hmm. they? Is there a danger of being so rigorous that you don't take into account some realm of possibility? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And, you know, I think especially things that are truly sort of, fringe, like Bigfoot, you know, it's been around for so long. And it's easy to sort of just dismiss that and say, okay, well, just I have no time for this. It doesn't exist. But at the same time, it's a matter of creating a hypothesis that's testable. Like, okay, let's say, and I have no problem with that. I have no problem with Meldrum and anybody else saying, I believe that there is, you know, an 8-foot-tall, hairy hominin as yet undiscovered in the Pacific Northwest or wherever else. I mean, there have been sightings, purported sightings all across the United States. You think Bigfoot is, you know, everywhere based upon this stuff. Fine. But how do we test that? What do we do? There are people who, you know, track and study, you know, really elusive wild animals like big cats, jaguars in Arizona, snow leopards in the Himalayas, that they – scientists who almost never ever see their quarry except in camera tracks or as tracks or as scat or some other sign. Why can't we apply that same sort of rigor to – and that's the thing. It's not on scientists, not on anthropologists or the main scientific community to sort of defend Bigfoot or investigate this. If people like Meldrum and other sort of Bigfoot aficionados think that there really is something out there, be rigorous about it. Actually do a real scientific study and say, you know, here's the area where we think this animal exists. How are we going to search for it? We're going to do this according to protocol. And if it comes up negative, fine. That's it. But instead, we get sort of schemes of $300,000 airships to go take pictures of this thing in the woods. And you have other groups, sort of, I think it's the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, who say on their website, we don't even really care if we find a body or not. And for that would be the main, that's, you know, the prize. That's the brass ring. That's what you want to get. That would be incontrovertible proof that this thing exists. And they're just not interested.
Why?
I don't know. I think that's a psychological question almost more than anything else. It's like, you know, it's almost risky. If they really did things sort of by the book, if they did things really in a way that ecologists and conservation biologists search for sort of missing animals or purported animals and they didn't find anything, then it would be pretty solid evidence that at least that the animal that they're looking for isn't there. Right. So they would sort of risk proving themselves wrong. It's almost a matter of faith that these things are still out there.
And they would be monumentally disappointed.
Well, absolutely.
Right? I mean, and that's something that they've devoted their I wouldn't say their lot. Well, some have. Like, I guess it's fair to say. But I think that's part of what sort of tempers their actual wanting to get into the scientific process is that it's that X-Files quote again, I want to believe.
Yeah. I think that's definitely part of it. And, you know, the various samples, for example, that come from the Ketchum DNA study, they're supposed to be collected by a woman who says there's a family of 10 Sasquatch who live on her Michigan property, and they come and visit her every day, and they, you know, play with her pony and, you know, things like that. You'd figure there would be some major – and, you know, I have no doubt that in her mind she thinks she's seeing something, or, you know, she's seeing something out there in the woods, but it doesn't necessarily have to be – Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And it's kind of disappointing to face that, you know, sort of the vagaries of human psychology and, you know, culture and sociology might explain more about Bigfoot than anything in terms of biology.
Does anything about Meldrum's theory make sense? I mean, he put aside the evidence question just for a moment. I know it's a crucial question. You can't put it aside entirely. But for just a moment, what's wrong with the idea that – based on his study of, you know, human locomotor adaptations and primate movements and early forms of bipedalism, that when he looks at a particular footprint, he's seeing something that what he calls spontaneity. He's seeing some animation there, a greater degree of flexibility than you see in human locomotion. That's what he says. That's what he talks about in his book. That's what he mentioned on our program, for example. Is there something at all plausible about that, just as a theory, for example?
Well, one of the things that I want to mention before I continue on is that it's not a theory. It's a hypothesis. And that's the difference.
Okay, good.
You know, a theory of gravity, a theory of evolution. It's something that is pretty much a fact. It's been tested over and over again that gives us expectations that we can test in the future. What Meldrum has are footprints that he's creating a hypothesis about based upon what he thinks he sees. The question is, how do we test this? Things like, you know, animation, spontaneity, you can't really quantify that, or if you can, it's relatively difficult to do. I imagine you have to do some complex, you know, biomechanical and mathematical modeling in order to distinguish between these things. So, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with the hypothesis. The question is, and this is really makes the difference between when we're doing science and when we're not, is how do we test this? You know, do we go out? Do we try and make the best fake Bigfoot feet that we can, and see? Okay, you know what? We gave this a shot. We ran these track tests. They look nothing like these ones out in nature. So maybe there is something there. Now, based upon those tracks, we can narrow down the area in which this animal might exist.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get some observations of it. So, you know, one question will lead to other questions. There is a way to go about this in which we could investigate it, but it just never seems to quite get there.
It seems like you get passion on both sides of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing we discovered, I think, from doing that program with Meldrum. There's there's another professor or associate professor or something like that at Idaho State University. His name escapes me right now, but he was so angry that we did that program. And I think I understand why he was upset. Mm-hmm. I think he feels like that Idaho State University is suffering, its reputation is suffering by having a tenured professor on staff who believes this kind of thing. And I guess maybe by extension he feels like that may affect his own reputation. I think he has these sort of natural and skeptical inclinations anyway to say this is all crazy. But he was really intense. In fact, he wouldn't really respond back to me. I tried to get him to engage in a conversation about it, and he really wasn't interested. I'm not sure why, but it's okay. But do you note that intensity of feeling?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
On both sides? Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I did a book review of a book, I think, called Bigfoot Life in Times of a Legend. And I said I enjoyed the book. I thought, you know, put forward a good sort of cultural explanation for a lot of, you know, Bigfoot sightings. And a Bigfoot, you know, self-proclaimed Bigfoot researcher showed up in the comments. And because the author and I disagreed with his take, he started calling us both homosexuals.
Wow.
You know, no evidence to the contrary, but I had to delete most of his comments on that post because he was just so rabid and sort of frothing about the fact that, you know, anybody would doubt sort of the veracity of his comments. And I see it with scientists all the time, not necessarily with things like this, not necessarily with fringe science, but just it's a regular part of the scientific method. Somebody comes out with the hypothesis. Somebody else says, no, you're entirely wrong.
Yeah.
It's not that way. It's
right.
This. And, you know, there are all kinds of, you know, scientific flame wars over just basic academic stuff, much less when somebody is making truly exceptional claims. So yeah, there's a lot of passion on both sides. And when you get those elements where people who are absolutely convinced that, you know, Sasquatch is real and, you know, nothing you can say is ever going to, you know, even make them doubt that. And you get someone on the other side who says, you know, like, I don't even have time to listen to this.
Yeah.
You can't get anywhere. Like I said, I think that, you know, Sasquatch is a legitimate area of study, but in a sort of sociological and cultural and historical sort of context. If you want to go about, you know, testing it biologically, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we could, you know, do a lot of good by doing that sort of thing. But I wouldn't call what has been done to date so far actual research.
So the question is, of course, what's the harm really in people wandering around the Pacific Northwest, you know, gathering with like-minded people and even making reality television programs, which there seem to be a lot of these days. Isn't it the same as people who are convinced there are ghosts? You know, you don't see any harm in that, do you? Or do you in some way?
I don't see it as a direct harm in a way. Like if people want to believe in Bigfoot, go out camping, you know, go looking for it, set up camera traps, that's their prerogative. You know, please be my guest. You know, have fun camping, enjoy our natural spaces. But what I find troubling is that symptomatic of a wider rejection of science. Yeah. And, you know, it's symptomatic of the same kind of thinking, like that I said before, it gets people to push young earth creationism in schools, deny that, you know, humans are causing global climate change. It's a sort of permissiveness that I see in the culture and sometimes in the media as well of saying, okay, this person has this idea. You know, that's nice for them. They're not really hurting anybody. We should just, you know, let them have this nice thing that they like. And we don't really question them on it. You know, if somebody says, you know, I want to teach that, you know, the world is 6,000 years old and that there were dinosaurs on the ark, they should be laughed out of town by all rights, no matter where they are in the United States. But the fact is that those people are getting on school boards and pushing that sort of thing in education. And it's the same – I see the same kind of thinking in a lot of cryptozoology. It's the sort of – wounded pride in a way of not being accepted into science and also perverting, if you will, the scientific process, trying to seem science-ish to push something that is really a matter of faith more than a matter of evidence. And so yeah, I mean, if you want to believe Bigfoot, be my guest. That's perfectly fine. I have no beef with that. But I try and use these instances like the story about Meldrum's sort of project to build an airship to go look for this thing as a target of opportunity in a way to explain, okay, how would we really do science? Because that's something that's not as politically charged. It's this kind of quirky thing that people do that I can then sort of take advantage of to show people, okay, how do we actually go about testing hypotheses? How do we go about actually evaluating evidence and hopefully getting people to, you know, apply that thing to other parts of their lives?
Brian Switek is with us. He's the author of Written in Stone and also a forthcoming book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, which looks at how the popular ideas about dinosaurs compare to the scientific facts. We invite you to join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, why do people believe in Bigfoot? Not just Bigfoot. There are other mythical or elusive monsters out there, sea creatures, the chupacabra. And what's the harm, really, in wanting to believe in a supernatural beast? Well, the science writer Brian Switek says there are costs to this kind of thing. He talks about how it blurs the line between belief and the actual scientific method. We're talking about it today, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brian Switek with us again, the author of Written in Stone and the forthcoming book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, is with us in studio. And joining us also is Lynn McNeil. She teaches folklore at Utah State University. Her work focuses on legend and belief, and we should mention that USU is home to the Fife Folklore Archives, which house a number of Bigfoot stories collected in Utah and the West. And Professor McNeil, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm glad I can be here.
So, boy, this is an incredibly broad question to get started. We'll sort of get it into the particulars. But broadly, why do people tell stories first about Bigfoot?
Why do people tell stories? Where there are a lot of potential answers to that. And if I can back up a little bit, I think one thing that's important to know about this kind of story, which we would call a folk narrative or a folk belief, is that folk culture is sort of distinguished from other types of culture by not being required thinking for anyone. You know, you don't have to read about Bigfoot in high school English classes, and you don't have to follow laws that involve Bigfoot in your state. And so we have a very non-institutional culture about Bigfoot. And as folklore studies will show, anytime people are not required to believe in something or tell stories about something but do anyway, there's a reason for it. You know, that implies that there's a reason for it. And that's what folklorists are really invested in, is figuring out, why do people perpetuate these stories or these beliefs when they don't have to? And, you know, one answer that I'm sure a lot of people would support is because they're true, they're somehow accurately representing reality.
I saw what I saw.
I saw what I saw. Yeah. There it is. I'm telling the story because it happened. I think, though, that what we see more often – not more often, maybe that's not fair – but what we see as often as because something happened is because there's some other benefit, a psychological benefit or a social benefit or a cultural benefit to this belief. And folklorists conveniently have no stake in the truth or untruth of folk beliefs. We get to set that aside. We are interested in what compels people to treat them as true or to consistently speculate about their truth. And I think that that is where we start finding a lot of really meaningful answers.
Yeah. What do the stories that you've heard, that you read, that other people have told, that you've encountered, do they have certain typical kinds of characteristics? I'm thinking, for example, of urban legends.
Mm-hmm.
They all have the similar kind of characteristic. It was told by a friend of the postman, right? Someone
yep.
not entirely connected to them. It's connected enough for it to sound legitimate.
Yep.
And they themselves saw mm-hmm. this particular thing.
Yeah.
Right? So do you see the same kinds of things in Bigfoot stories? That is to say, again, not suggesting whether they're true or not, but that they have similar kinds of characteristics.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do see the same sort of thing. And you're right that urban legends share a lot of features. Folklorists call that friend of a friend chain the FOAF, the F-O-A-F.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So we love our terminology. and also what you're talking about is the process of authentication that people go through when telling a narrative that they know is going to be reacted to with doubt. And so we see these forms of authentication. With urban legends, we get a lot of attribution to the mass media or specific names and places. No, this happened in this small town.
No,
in
I
Texas.
Read it in the
yeah.
Times.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Things like that. With Bigfoot, one of the ways we see authentication is that people display their rationality. And that's really an interesting thing to me.
Wait, display their
rationality. Yes. Yeah, so we see people indicating their rational thought when they tell these stories. So they say, well, of course, my first thought was that it was a bear. Because yeah. they know that's rational. And then they go, but it couldn't have been a bear because it moved in this way, or there aren't bears in this area, or whatever. And then they go, and then there was this terrible smell. And at first I thought it had to be an elk rutting or something. And then they go, but it couldn't have been that because that was the wrong season. And I guess it could have been an out-of-season elk, but – and
so they raise the question.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
they dispute the question, and they raise the next
exactly.
one.
Exactly. And yeah, so they wow. present themselves as logical beings who have not jumped to – the supernatural conclusion, but who have resigned themselves often to it. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people. I know Brian mentioned the story of the woman who has 10 Bigfoots in her yard playing with her horses. And there are people who tell that story. But when we look at the power or the authority of folk culture, we're looking at consensus. And that tends mm. not to be the consensus about Bigfoot. The consensus is much more contained, much more restrained than those sort of enthusiastic, I'm going to believe no matter what. A lot of the stories we find in the archive are suggestions more than declarations of belief.
Is there an age dynamic here? Are young people less inclined to tell stories about Bigfoot as people from another generation?
Not really. Not that I've seen, at least, with Bigfoot stories. It's something that definitely spans age. And it tends to span culture, which is another one of those reasons that we see a real emphasis on belief when we have that cross-cultural pattern of belief. Mm. Using the example of, say, the invisible dragon in the garage. Yeah, it's one thing when one person tells you that and you kind of go, okay, show me this garage. You know, let me walk through the space and perceive if there's anything in it. It takes on a whole different level if thousands of people from across the country are separately from each other starting to report sightings of dragons in garages or something like this, because then we've brought in a new form of authority, which is consensus, cultural consensus or group consensus.
Yeah. Do you you've quoted the scholar Robert Pyle,
mm-hmm.
who makes this argument that people don't want to find Bigfoot, they want to be Bigfoot.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
What I think we see as far as a psychological function of Bigfoot belief is that it is incredibly meaningful to people that Bigfoot could be real. I mean, we live in a day and an age where, for the most part, wilderness is known.
Yeah.
You know, we have national parks. We've controlled the wilderness. We've put boundaries around it. We can pay an entry fee and visit it.
There's
and,
always a plane flying
yes,
over.
Exactly.
You're not far from the road.
Yeah. And I think the idea that a creature could exist beautifully in tandem with nature, completely separate from human awareness, totally isolated and flourish and perpetuate itself and its species is a very comforting thought. I think that resonates with people. They hear the story and go, well, I don't know if I believe you, you know, in your story, though I hear you saying that you've gone through a critical thinking process as well. But man, that sure is I would like that to be the case, you know, and not that it's all wishful thinking, but I do think that there is a very comforting impression of the wilderness there. And of course, as Robert Pyle observes, people looking for Bigfoot get to act like him.
Yeah.
They get to go be in the places Bigfoot would be and act the way Bigfoot would act. And that is a connection with nature that perhaps we don't always have anymore, and it's a way to have it.
Brian Sweetek, let me bring you back into the conversation. What do you make of that? Do you see something to that idea that people are trying to make sense of dwindling wilderness or something that's more finite than it used to seem, you know?
There's something definitely to that, and I can identify with that. As we mentioned before, as a kid, you know, I wanted to be that guy who goes out and finds these monstrous things out in the woods, you know, have an adventure. And I think there's that sort of camping culture sort of subsumed within this sort of stuff, especially now since, you know, Bigfoot isn't just, you know, sort of a myth and a legend. It's marketing. You know, he sells us beer and beef jerky. Yes, yes.
Right.
So it's a way almost to – I mean, this is just me doing pop psychology here off the top of my head, but it's a way to sort of almost – reclaim it. You know, it's something wild, it's something monstrous, it's something, you know, out there in the deep dark woods where, you know, a lot of these stories about humanoids from, you know, China to North America and elsewhere have cropped up. So I think there's definitely an element of that in it.
George Schaller, we'd mentioned him before, the American mammalogist and conservationist. He said this, that we're interested in a creature like Bigfoot because we're seeking some kind of evolutionary bridge to connect ourselves to something closer to us than the known great apes. What do you think about that? That's an interesting concept.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea because we've lost all of our closest relatives. I mean, we had Neanderthals up until, you know, just a few thousand years ago. We interbred with them even. You know, many of us on this planet are part Neanderthal genetically. And throughout the entire course, 6 million years of human evolution, there's been, you know, upwards of 5 or 6 different species of human present together, you know, on the same continent or throughout the world at the same time. And now it's just us.
Yeah.
So it would sort of plug into that idea that, you know, now there's this evolutionary gap between us and chimpanzees. There's nothing in between. And, you know, Bigfoot always seems to crop up right in the middle of that gap.
What do you think?
I think what I see there more than a biological bridge, I see more of a conceptual bridge that is appealing, a bridge between the known and the unknown, or a bridge between the natural and the supernatural that is very appealing in potential discovery arenas. You know what I mean? I think that what we see when we call something supernatural, all we're saying is it's outside what we know about nature. We're not declaring it to be a certain way. We're declaring it outside of what we know.
Yeah.
And so through the history of time, there have been things that were once perceived outside of nature that are then brought into it and believed, understood to be a part of nature. And that's an ongoing process. And I think that a lot of this interest in the science or pseudoscience of Bigfoot is in crossing that bridge, bringing something unknown into the known or bringing something supernatural into the natural. And there are so many broader implications if we can just do that once. You know, if we can photograph a ghost or get a Bigfoot DNA sample, that just opens up the realms of possibility in a very appealing way for a lot of people.
In some ways, that has already happened with the giant squid. I mean, sea serpents, you know, people used to think that are these giant reptilian things out in the ocean, and then it turned out most of these are probably attributable to giant colossal squid out there. So you have this real natural, you know, actually monstrous thing that now has a scientific name, has technical descriptions. You know, people are going about trying to actually conserve this animal. I think, you know, for at least some people, Bigfoot researchers, that's the kind of thing that they'd like to happen.
You know, what's interesting about that story, though, is that started as a silly myth. They were seeing something, or they were seeing some kind of slime that was that they couldn't quite figure out.
Right.
And then it turned out to be something, which is interesting about that relationship between the stories that seem crazy and the thing that actually happens. That's an interesting connection.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it shows what the value of folk belief is. I think from my perspective, not as a scientist, perhaps, I think it's somewhat of a false dichotomy to pit folk belief and science against each other. I don't think that we benefit from that. And I think that sort of modern scientific rationalism has successfully pathologized folk belief for a really long time, seen it as sort of a contamination of reality or of truth. And I think the fact is that we stand to gain much more from allowing people who espouse folk beliefs to be perceived as rational, if not correct. We tend to equate someone being rational with someone therefore drawing correct conclusions. And I think we need to allow people who might perhaps be incorrect to still be rational because we stand to gain something like we do with the giant squid. There was a marine biologist at Memorial University of Newfoundland, Frederick Aldrich, who was interested in this. There happens to be a big folklore archive at Memorial University of Newfoundland. And one of the ways that he pursued scientific knowledge of the giant squid was to look at the folk narratives, sailor stories that cropped up about it and start beginning identifying patterns and certain climate situations that would lead to, you know, greater sightings of this particular sea creature. And he actually put up wanted posters that are pretty amusing. They show kind of a classic, you know, kraken creature taking down a ship or something or attacking people on shore. But he ended up with one of the first full specimens of the giant squid. And I think that's one of those things we stand to gain by not dismissing folk belief, by not acting as though it's a disease that we need to overcome or cure in society.
So, Brian, what do you think about that? Where do you draw the line? I mean, I guess the question is, are oral traditions and stories, can you consider that part of at least initially the process of collecting some kind of evidence?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how to go about cryptozoology as a zoologist in a way, is collect stories and say, okay, let's say around the islands of the Pacific, you have stories of some long-necked thing. Use those stories where they're collected, pinpoint where you might actually search for this animal, and then conduct a search, you know, in a rigorous sort of manner. I mean, someone actually in a way did this. It's sort of a joke, but they took Bigfoot sightings, either audio or visual or otherwise, from California up through Washington. And they plotted all these on a map. And they said, okay, based upon this, what is the habitat of Bigfoot? Where would we expect to find it? And then plotted those out. And it turned out to be the same as black bear habitat. So, I mean, chances are these explain a lot of these sightings. But there is a way to actually use this. There is a way to use folklore. And we've actually seen this in the field that I usually concentrate in paleontology, collecting folklore and legends of Native Americans, of Greeks and Romans, things about, you know, giants attributed to big teeth or big bones coming out of the ground that can usually be tied to some kind of fossil site. So there is definitely a place where I think sort of this approach from the humanities and approach from science can meet and mutually benefit each other. It doesn't really do us any good to be entirely dismissive off the bat. But if we're going to say, okay, is there a Bigfoot? We need to apply that scientific portion, not just say we have all these sightings, but say, okay, given these sightings, what would we predict about where this animal exists? Where do we search?
Use that as a starting point.
Right. Use it to frame our hypothesis and then test it.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Mark is joining us in Ogden. Mark, forgive the wait. Welcome.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead.
My question was, how does social media play into all of this, into the hype? And, you know, I run a Facebook page, and I love astronomy, and I get a lot of questions about, you know, end of the world and things like that. How does that play into the hype that's going on? I take my question off the air.
Great. Thanks very much. Lynn, you first.
Yeah, I think it plays an enormous role, really, because what new communications technologies, one of the things that they've done is amplify a lot of voices that didn't have amplification before. And so people whose experiences or opinions or thoughts or personal hypotheses might not extend beyond their home community now have the world as an audience, thanks to Twitter, Facebook, the internet, blogs, all of these things. And I think that, and I don't know if Brian would agree with me, but I think that that's one of the things that factors in here is whose voice is rising to the top. You know, it's one thing for me to say if I look at all of the, you know, 60-some-odd Bigfoot sightings that we have in our archives, and most of them are hesitant, rational, not overstepping the conclusions that are being drawn. But there's maybe two or three that are just full-fledged, there's a community of Bigfoots that live near my house. That's the voice that's probably going to take off on, you know, the network, on Twitter, on social media. That's the one that's going to be the best to advertise beer or beef jerky. And so we have, in a sense, through mass media, almost a misrepresentation of folk culture in a way, though that's one of our biggest avenues now for folk culture. So I think it's something we're just going to have to contend with.
And I guess the internet would be interesting because really the internet has Brian Switek, you found a home there to be able to raise questions when you found science journalism wanting.
Right. I've kind of made a career out of being a pain to other professional journalists. But
I know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to bring this up is that in that same post that I criticized you, I also criticized Ira Flatow of Science Friday because around that time there was a hypothesis put forward by a researcher that this bed of marine reptiles out in Nevada was created by a giant artistic kraken. So it was this giant squid that left like a self-portrait of itself in bone. And he had no evidence for this whatsoever, but he immediately took off because the press release was just so sensational and so many people reprinted it without really thinking twice about it. And I think reporting plays into this as well is when you're going to – if somebody says I have Bigfoot DNA evidence or I have a Triassic Kraken or I met an ancient alien or something, when you write that story, do you say – okay, there's this off-the-wall report coming from here, or there's this highly controversial statement being made by this person. You immediately frame it as, okay, this is something that might not be true. We're going to investigate it. Or do you give that person the full – most of the length of the page to lay out their idea, and then you just have that one scientist at the end saying, no, I think this is bunk.
Yeah, which is kind of what we did is what you're saying, right? I mean, and we didn't even have the other scientist on until a year later. That's what you're here for, Brian Sweetek. Brian's the author of Written in Stone, the forthcoming book, My Beloved Brontosaurus. And Lynn McNeil is with us, teaches folklore at Utah State University. We need to take another brief break. Mark, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about, this question. Why do people believe in Bigfoot or other mythical or elusive monsters or creatures, sea creatures, chupacabras, stuff like that? 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Bill sent this email. He said, the Falcon Project to look for Bigfoot via a blimp on Kickstarter may be a positive comment on the public skepticism, at least when it comes to donating dollars for so-called Bigfoot research. As of this morning, the project has six backers pledging $376 toward a $355,000 goal, only 45 days to go. He said, I personally think the Bigfoot blimp surveillance idea is more about getting media attention than a legitimate attempt at scientific research. He says our world and universe are exciting and mysterious enough without mythic beasts. Here's JL who writes, in reaction to your guest saying why we tell stories about Bigfoot, I like to share them and hear them because they infuse life with some kind of mystery and wonder. I like to at least half believe that there's more to our world than meets the eye. You think that's part of this?
Oh, definitely. I think that that's absolutely a part of this. I think that there is an emotional, psychological, maybe even a biological need for wonder, for mystery, for not knowing, and for chewing over that. You know, when you hear a Bigfoot story and your friend is saying, I saw this thing in the canyon and there was a smell and it looked like it had shaggy,
and it couldn't have been a bear.
Here are all the ways I know it wasn't a bear or an elk or whatever. Yeah. You don't respond by going, oh, wow, yeah, so I guess Bigfoot's there. You know, you respond by debating, by picking that up. And that's really the spirit of folk legends and folk belief, is the active debate, not the wholesale belief.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Kelly, welcome.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question for Brian. I'm not sure if you have children, but if you do, I was curious, do you tell your children that Santa Claus exists, even though there's no scientific proof? And I'm wondering what your opinion on the comparison between Santa Claus or Bigfoot or the invisible dragon in the garage. It's a fascinating story that we tell our children, even though we know that there's no proof, but we still do it. So what's the difference between that and people believing in Sasquatch or Bigfoot?
You ever get that question before, by the way?
No, because I don't have kids.
Okay. That's a tough one.
Yeah. But, well, I've thought about it a little bit just in terms of I'd probably say, there's a lot of legends that, people say that there's a thing. I'd probably be honest and say, no, he's not a real person that comes down the chimney. I'd crush my children's dreams. I'm a terrible person. But I would, try and enjoy some of the folklore and legends, the various versions of Santa Claus that have been around. I mean, maybe that's just me being a science geek, but that's the way I'd go about it anyway.
It's interesting, Lynn McNeil. I wonder, do you get a kind of, since this is There are a lot of – this is again, this is the home of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Do you get a Mormon spin on folklore on Bigfoot stories?
Yeah, we do actually, and we have several of them in the Fife archives up at USU. There's a localized – and as far as I know, it's pretty much only in Utah – a belief that Bigfoot is actually Cain, Abel's brother, wandering
biblical
the
Cain,
earth.
Right.
Yeah, the biblical Cain. He's often described as – wearing something, whereas a lot of depictions of Bigfoot who are interpreted as Bigfoot is not wearing anything. So we'll get descriptions of a large hairy man in a loincloth or something, and he's often depicted in that way. And that's a really common pattern, actually, that local beliefs get infused with cross-cultural beliefs. And there's, you know, folklorists have borrowed the term ecotypification from biology for that, that you can have a localized form of a plant, you can have a localized form of a legend where local cultures and beliefs have been sort of immersed into a story that exists multi-locally.
Yeah. I don't have time to get to Dennis's call, but let me just sort of see if I can paraphrase it. Dennis is calling from Centerville. He says, some of the harm that you can cause with this, he talks about how there were, for example, he's talking about autism research, 20 studies wasting time and money. You know, you're wasting money on this stuff when you could be applying all that energy and all those resources to autism research, for example. Right. What do you think about that, Brian Sweetick? Do you worry about that?
To a minor extent, I mean, this isn't something quite serious. Lives are not necessarily on the line with Bigfoot research, but you know, for people like Jeff Meldrum or other sort of professional anthropologists or zoologists who are interested in this sort of thing, you know, like we mentioned, this Blimp project is $350,000. You know, if that was raised through grants or other things through the NSF or what other organizations, that'd probably be a huge waste of money. It's the opportunity cost of going after something that probably isn't there. I'm not really bothered by the fact that people want to do this. If you're, you know, a professional anthropologist, go for it. Just do it. Figure out how to do it and get out there and stop wasting time, really. It's the years and years of not coming up with evidence and saying, well, it may still be out there. That just kind of burns me a little bit.
Yeah. Lynn McNeil, let me ask you this finally. I guess these stories aren't going away.
No, definitely not. And I think that persistence is going to help provide them with sort of that folk authority for a really long time.
Lynn McNeil teaches folklore at Utah State University. Thanks for being with us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Brian Sweetick, you were a great sport. Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. He's the author of Written in Stone, and he's got a forthcoming book called My Beloved Brontosaurus, which looks at how the popular ideas about dinosaurs compare to the scientific facts. We'll have you on for that.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Very gracious.
Thanks for being with us. Radio West, a production of KUER News. The Moth and the Flame composed our theme music. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.